Welcome to Coastless, the podcast for those navigating a connection-based travel lifestyle. I'm Boyce Richardson.
And I'm Melissa Yeager. This week on the pod, we're welcoming Ashley Z. Hand, the co-founder of CityFi and the first chief innovation officer for the city of Kansas City, to talk about the future of public transit and connectivity in Kansas City, as well as some of the differences between transit in the Midwest versus other rails in the country. But first, let's talk about some of our favorite transit systems. It really is interesting that different cities have a different feel for their transit systems. And Boyce, wondering what's your favorite transit system when you have traveled domestically and abroad?
Well, I think it's funny because experience always manages to impact your perspective on transit infrastructure. I'm in Chicago all the time, whether or not it be for work or just for personal travel or visiting friends. And I've always had kind of an affinity for the L, just been on it so many times. The ability to take the orange line in from Midway or the blue line in from O'Hare, watching either the south side of Chicago on the orange line or the north side as you're traveling south to get into the downtown loop, and just seeing the buildings go by. And I can remember it was one of the first U.S. cities I ever visited, or at least one that was big enough to have some sort of mass transit infrastructure. And you just see these giant buildings go by, and just skyscrapers for what feel like miles. And it just has a certain distinctly Midwestern feel to it that you don't necessarily get in the grime and lived in nature of the New York metro. But yeah. And then, you know, again, abroad, having lived in Tokyo, the subway system there is, you know, despite the fact that I may have ridden it too long, gotten outside of the Tokyo metro and not realized that I was on a express train every once in a while, and had very kind Japanese people tap me on the shoulder and tell me of the errors of my ways in order to get me back into the metropolitan area. But it's hard not to love the tube in London as well. Just kind of a similar thing. You get to see not only the external views, but sort of the internal tunnels where people are dressed for work and they're just going about their regular days. And it's always this weird juxtaposition when you're traveling abroad or even domestically when you're off of work and everybody else is going to work and everybody else is living their lives. And you're just sitting there with headphones in, kind of smiling, looking at life go by, enjoying your travels and kind of trying to evaluate life. And one of the things that I love the most about transit is just the ability to throw in a pair of headphones, the latest album that I've been listening to on repeat, and just kind of sit back and relax and take in a new culture with my eyes for a while.
Yeah. Now that I am stuck in traffic hell every day, I miss being on public transit and being able to do other things while I'm getting to my destination, being able to respond to emails, listen to music, chat with friends. You know, you can't do that when you're in a solo in a car, like trying to make sure, you know, whatever aggressive driver next to you is not going to run you over. That said, I think part of that is my culture shock coming back home from Berlin. I love that their system, you pay a flat fee for your card for the month. I can't remember what it was, like 80 euros. And that includes your U-Bahn, your S-Bahn, your bus, your streetcar. All of those things are included in it. And so it's really kind of depressing to now go back to driving a car when you could get to all of those different places and with different forms of transportation. There really wasn't a place in the city you couldn't get to by public transit. And I think that's what's really disappointing in the United States. I think that's why it's difficult for people to get used to public transit, because there are so many holes in where you can get to compared to Europe.
Yeah, and I think it contributes to some other fairly negative aspects of American society in terms of our sort of overall lethargy and sedentariness at times.
Yeah.
Mass transit just facilitates the ability where you have a multimodal means of transportation where you can walk to a train or you can walk and then bike. And it just makes it so much easier to combine all these modes of transportation and get you from one segment of the city to the other without having to be focused on driving a car the entire time, where you have to park, what you have to do. You know, there are so many times where the monotony can just set in, where you remove the car from the garage, you take the car to where it's supposed to go. You park it, you take an elevator up to where you're supposed to be, you sit there all day long, and then you take that same elevator back down, get the car out of the parking garage and take it back to your garage. And it's just this thing on an endless loop. And one of the beautiful things about mass transit is the fact that you experience and interact with people in such a different way on a daily basis, where nothing is ever quite the same, especially in places like New York, where, you know, there's buskers on the subway, there's crazy people on the subway. And if you take a weekend there and nobody shouts weird obscenities at you as you're riding along, you've just not done it right.
Well, and I would say, as a someone who commuted both in Washington, D.C. and in Berlin to work, there's that time that you're on public transit that allows you to decompress from your workday, you know, by listening to music or whatever. Whereas when you're in the car, you're still like actively using your mind to make sure that you stay on the road and don't hit people and, you know, stop at the stoplights. And then you get home and you need a little bit more time to decompress when you get home. Whereas, you know, I would be able to wander through neighborhoods, stop at, you know, stores, stop for grab dinner or whatever on the way home, and then come home and be fully like decompressed from my day. So just my rah-rah for public transit.
Well, I'm not sure why it is, but there's something sort of innately not quite as frustrating about waiting on mass transit where you're just kind of at peace with the world, and then waiting in a car where, you know, there's not quite as easy to gauge how long it's going to take you to get home. But it's not relaxing to be waiting in that car when you're stuck in the middle of rush hour traffic and there's nowhere right. for you to go, and people are screaming and honking and all that other nonsense. You know, it's so much more relaxing to just be in your seat, sort of immersed in a book or some other form of media, and just kind of tuning out for a while.
Yeah, not to say that the metro in D.C. isn't a little stressful right now as they're going through repairs. I remember they've had a couple fires, which were quite frightening. If you look up on YouTube, you can find some pictures of ones that were quite scary, caught on the closed caption television systems. But you know, I really wish we would do more to invest in this. I think it would be beneficial to us to have better public transportation systems.
So you just spent the last few minutes being rah-rah about public transit. I think we owe it to the listeners before we get into this interview for you to talk about some of your least favorite transit infrastructure cities in the world.
Oh, man. I would say, that's hard. I found Russia difficult because I don't speak Russian. and you know, I'm disappointed in Washington, D.C.'s system right now, though they do have a lot of different, you know, they have the circulator, they have the bus, your Metro card covers a lot. But I hate that you have to pay individually for each trip. I think it should be a flat fee and everybody should be able to use it. And then pretty much any place where as a visitor where you can't, you would have to rent a car, I find annoying, you know. So those are mine. What about you?
You know, I really found Munich's transportation system to be very difficult and not user-friendly.
Really?
Yeah, when we got in, we were just trying to figure out the train system and trying to make sure, obviously, because neither one of us read German or can read German, and trying to figure out
from the airport?
Yeah, from the airport. We tried.
That one is a little difficult.
Yeah, we tried to get out there and get tickets, and then we didn't know whether or not we'd purchased the right one, and we had just gotten there, and I was convinced that some German person was going to come kick us off the train, and that who knows how we'd get downtown. Yeah, it's a weird reality that Uber has changed things so much. I mean, even a decade ago, when you got into a foreign environment, you could struggle through transit if you didn't understand the language, you had some difficulties. And now we're experiencing a cultural shift a little bit where people are so willing, especially during travel. And I'm 100% guilty of this, of just being like, logistically, this might be difficult. I'm just not going to deal with it. And I'm going to get an Uber and not worry about having to process this. And it's something that I'd like to divorce myself of. But I will say, in the US, my least favorite transit system is MARTA in Atlanta, which is just horrible. It's just awful.
I would say I think the Uber thing is an American attitude too, because I think elsewhere people are more trained to use public transit first. So, and I will rah-rah the German transit system one more time. What I also love about it is that there are no turnstiles. You just buy your ticket and you punch it, you validate it. And then they have these secret cops that come out and they check your ticket. And if you don't have a valid ticket, they give you a ticket. You can either pay then or pay later. And I love it because it's so easy. I don't love it because you can easily forget not to renew your ticket. And then the surprise cops will jump out. I saw these guys, they sat on the train with me for at least like 5 stops before they suddenly jumped out and started checking everybody's tickets. It was fantastic. I loved it.
So. You know, I am here for the tap card. The L has it. The T has it. You know, Japan's subway system's built on it. So is the tube. You know, should Kansas City's bus system ever kind of expand and go multimodal with a streetcar extension and, you know, Clay Chastain's ever dreamed of light rail. It is the thing that for me makes it most easy is just to be able to just tap the bottom of your wallet on there and enter in and out without issue. Just I found to be the least frustrating form of being able to pay for that and ensuring that you do not end up getting kicked off of a German train.
You'll get pulled off, but you'll just have to pay a ticket. And on that note, I think a lot of that depends on, you know, changing how people perceive public transit. And so this week we're talking to Ashley Z. Hand, the co-founder of CityFi, and our interview with her is next.
This week on the pod, we are joined by Ashley Hand, the co-founder of CityFi and former first chief innovation officer for the city of Kansas City, Missouri. Ashley, welcome to the pod.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right. For our listeners who may not know, what is CityFi and what are its overarching goals?
So CityFi is an advisory services that look at urban change management. So how do cities adapt in the future? As we think about the period of rapid technological innovation, there's so much going on that have a lot of impact, not just on how we live and work, but also on kind of the economic and social health of our communities. And so we try to find a way that can address the future of change through the triple bottom line. So thinking about people first in an era of rapid technological innovation.
And I know CityFi says that it works to help facilitate sustainable change for people and the environment. What do you guys actually mean by that?
Well, you know, if you think about what happened when we had the technological innovation around automobiles, as an example, it was really exciting technology that opened up a lot of possibilities for our cities and our communities around the country. However, we made a lot of choices in the near term that have had generational impacts on the health of our cities. It divided communities, the way that we designed our roadways and highway systems. It created unwalkable communities that impacted our public health. And so it really is about thinking through what is the potential consequences of these technologies and ensuring that we focus on a human-centered approach to thinking through city design and public policy and different ways of approaching some of the urban problems that we see in our cities today.
And so before we get too far into this interview, since you bring up the issue of cars, can we talk a little bit about public perception of public transportation, especially in Kansas City or in America in general? People love their cars. And so how does that play into your work of convincing people to perhaps start using public transit or thinking of their transit in a sustainable way?
So public transit, I think, first of all, is changing. So I think what we can traditionally think of as kind of the fixed route bus system, where you have a schedule of buses that show up maybe 20, 30 minutes apart from each other along a specific route throughout a city, that is changing. So I think it's really important to note that, first of all. The challenge that public transit has seen is that there's been a rapid decline in ridership in most cities that haven't done something pretty significant to change user experience. And that's because smartphones and technologies that we have available in our pocket have enabled more alternatives. So people are opting out of walking or biking or even taking public transit for those shorter trips and jumping into an Uber or Lyft, for example, much to the detriment of ridership of our transit systems. But at a reasonable kind of, if you think about the average person, you know, when we think about the convenience and the perceived convenience of driving from point A to point B, you know, getting into a car and driving yourself is often the cheapest way to do it. So the, you know, free parking in cities across the country has also decimated public transit because it's made it really easy for people to kind of ignore the actual cost of automobile ownership and just jump in their car to make that trip. So there's a lot that needs to be done in public transit to not only address user experience, but also to start thinking about how we price transportation as a system to make sure that we really are choosing the most sustainable and perhaps even the more convenient solutions that are available to us.
So CityFi helps cities incorporate current and new technologies. And I'm wondering if you can give some examples of how that plays out in the real world. What does that look like when we talk about using current and new technologies?
Well, I think, well, one thing I'd say is, first of all, CityFi is technology agnostic. We can't presume to anticipate what will win. So the example being of autonomous vehicles, you can't really be sure how the technology is going to play out. That is still very much in its infancy. People are testing it, but there's a long way to go in the evolution of this technology, which I believe will be revolutionary when it is fully market driven. But the reality is that we're a long way away from that. So what we do is we try to anticipate what the potential opportunities are and how we might deploy that technology in a way that is allowing us to really solve true urban issues. And so when we think about autonomous vehicles, for example, if we were to replace single occupancy vehicles, so I drive myself by myself to and from, if we were to replace each of those cars with a self-driving car, we're actually not solving traffic issues or congestion issues. In fact, we might be potentially creating worse congestion because suddenly I might be able to now let my car go run around and do errands for me when I go pop in to do an errand myself or go to work or something like that in lieu of parking the vehicle. And now you're creating additional vehicle miles trips or other basically trips that wouldn't have existed otherwise. So the intent of making safer roads because autonomous vehicles can eliminate human error and potentially make a greener ride because it's anticipated much of the autonomous vehicles will be electric. If we don't start thinking about sharing as part of that model, we're really missing an opportunity to transform the efficiency of our transportation network. And in cities like Los Angeles or New York, where you have lots of congestion to begin with, having robot cars driving around empty could be detrimental to the movement around cities as a whole. And so it's really important to think about how do we create the policy framework today, the vision of what we want to see this technology to, and how it's going to be used, and ensure that it's really addressing a problem. That's the other thing, is that as brilliant as some of these ideas are coming out of Silicon Valley and some of the tech innovation spaces across the country, they're not always addressing true urban issues. It's just more of a kind of a cool trick that really is exciting and a shiny new object, but isn't really changing the way that we're thinking about how to solve problems at the city level.
In light of the unsure future you just discussed, if you were in charge of Kansas City, let's say you were Mayor Sly James or Troy Schulte, what specific transit areas would you focus on?
Actually, I would have to say, I think the KCATA is doing a really great job of rethinking public transit in Kansas City. It's an uphill battle. As was mentioned earlier, there is not a culture of transit ridership among the general public. Choice riders, or those who have an option to do something other than ride the bus, often do not choose to ride the bus. But Robbie Mackinnon and the leadership over at KCATA are really thinking beyond the traditional bus that we as we know it, and experimenting with a lot of different modes that could potentially be integrated into a bus system to make sure that you really have options. Because when you think about mobility, it really is about right sizing the solution to the type of trip that you're making. So for me as a mom, the commute that I make in the morning with my two girls is easy on the streetcar because I can get from door to door without much of a change. But if I'm going to take my groceries somewhere, I might need a slightly different vehicle that can help me carry the groceries to and from my home and where I'm shopping. But then going to a work trip that's maybe a little bit different and maybe off the beaten path of a traditional transit route in Kansas City, I need another alternative. And so the KCATA has been experimenting with things like integrating the bicycle network into their transit system, thinking differently about micromobility or the e-scooters that you see all over town, thinking about how you connect it to something called microtransit, which are on-demand shuttles that really allow you to kind of call up a shuttle bus as you need it instead of having to wait for the scheduled time when it would arrive on a fixed route. And that brings a lot more flexibility into the transit network as we know it. So I think one thing, if I were to kind of think about regional leadership and what the opportunity is that Kansas City really has to pursue, is how do we fund public transit? Currently, the majority of funding for the KCATA does come from the city of Kansas City, Missouri, which is fine in some ways because that's where a lot of the ridership is. But the reality is, as a true regional network, which is really how we work as a community, we need to have regional funding. And so I think that's where the biggest opportunity for the city of Kansas City, Missouri is to continue to champion and hopefully advance a conversation across the region as to how do we pay for a truly regional public transit system.
You referenced this earlier when you were responding to Melissa's question with respect to kind of getting people out of their relationship with their vehicles. But what are some of the things that Kansas City could do in the very near future to improve infrastructure and increase utilization or usage?
So there's a couple different things. And I actually thought a lot about this when I did some work in Los Angeles for Mayor Garcetti, looking at the future of mobility. And I called it transportation happiness. So really thinking about user experience, which is something I mentioned early on in the conversation. When we think about how a system is designed, it has to serve all types of users. You know, if you're designing for children and for and senior citizens and people with physical disabilities, you might be able to design a system that's more universally accessible and approachable. And that's really important. And that requires thinking through how do station stops get designed? Do we provide some protection from the elements? We do have four incredibly diverse seasons, and sometimes one season can have a whole bunch of different types of weather in it. It's really important to think about how do we provide for human comfort in the types of trips that people are taking. So thinking through what that user experience is and then designing the network around that is really important. As well are the connections. So, you know, you can't expect a bus route, for example, to always be perfect in getting you from point A to point B. So you have to make sure that you have sidewalk networks that get you to the transit stops or bicycle networks that get you to those transit stops that are comprehensive and complete. And while the streets themselves need to serve all users, so you have to think about complete street infrastructure, which means looking not just at four lanes, or maybe in some cases, six lanes of arterial traffic, but really thinking through how does this feel as a pedestrian to cross this intersection? Do I have enough time at the intersection from a pedestrian signal? Does it feel safe when I'm halfway across and I feel like the light's going to turn? Do I have an area of refuge that I can wait that feels like I'm protected from other people moving through that intersection? Those are things that are easily done just in terms of transforming the way that we design the physical space itself. Then there's other tools that you can use to start to integrate what's available to you. Mobility as a service is this idea that you could have a single platform that unifies multiple modes of transportation. So I could take a bus, or I could take a bike share. I could potentially take a car share or an Uber or a Lyft. I might even be able to, you know, jump into a long distance train or something like that. All those networks could be potentially integrated into a single platform through an app. And I could even schedule and pay for those services. And then that makes it a lot easier for me to weigh my choices so that when I am kind of thinking, okay, well, I'm not too sure how I'm going to get from point A to point B. I don't really know what my options are. I can really look at, hey, in this case, it might be faster for me to take these couple modes to get where I'm going, or it might be cheaper for me to take these modes to go where I'm going, and really allowing people to explore what their options are. And then finally, another way that we can start to change behavior is really thinking about incentives. It's really kind of simple. It's hard to try something new, and we often are resistant to change. But when you once you have the opportunity to experience, as human beings, we're much more adaptive than we give ourselves credit. So I think it's important to give ourselves a room to try new things. And there's a variety of ways that we can incentivize behavior change. Employers can incentivize alternatives to driving. So not paying for parking or not providing copious amounts of free parking, but offering public transit passes as an alternative way to getting to work. Frequent flyer programs, for example, for communities and people that work for companies that have lots of travel to KCI could offer an alternative to parking at the airport in a subsidized way. They could incentivize public transit out to the airport, and that would start to shift that behavior. And I think we see that working both through employers, through cities, and even on a kind of a very individual level. There's an app out there that allows for simple incentives for example, trying bike riding 10 times over a month. You get a coupon to a local cafe or a discount at a certain store. And this is something that is important because this app obviously wants to collect the data on as to how you're traveling. But on the other side of it, it's incentivizing you to try something a little bit more environmentally friendly as an alternative. And I think those are really promising solutions.
Beyond being the co-founder of CityFi, you're also a LEED certified architect. How does your education as an architect impact your present role and impact your ability to facilitate and identify kind of private-public partnerships?
So I think the training that I have as an architect and the licensing process that I had to go through over several years certainly got me to start thinking about things in terms of systems. And when we think about our cities, they're very complex systems, and there is no single solution that's going to be the silver bullet. So you really have to think about how do you design for something that has a lot of different factors and often a lot of changing elements to it. And I think as an architect, I certainly can appreciate the complexity of that, but then I can apply the design thinking approach to problem solving. And as a result of that, I think that's really informed kind of a broader thinking about how do we address our challenges in our cities today. Well, no single government has the manpower, the dollars, or the physical resources that they could potentially have at their fingertips to solve some of the massive problems that our cities are facing. So we need to have new players at the table. And so what we're starting to see more and more in smart cities is the introduction of data-driven decision-making. And this is essential. And I think it opens up who the parties might be to work together in solving that. And as an architect, I think, you know, understanding how you can navigate between multiple players at the table, create a common vision, and work towards a shared outcome is something that you would do in a design project, but it's something that we do almost every day at CityFi.
You mentioned that you also do work in Los Angeles, and I can't think of probably two more diverse places than Kansas City and Los Angeles. But I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about how transportation issues differ between those two communities.
The constraints are completely different. So in Los Angeles, the average person spends about 104 hours stuck in traffic every year.
I thought Phoenix.
It really puts things in perspective. And I do chuckle to myself when anyone talks about traffic here in Kansas City. I really feel like, you know what, you've got it pretty good, folks. You need to pump your brakes on I-35. That doesn't qualify as traffic in my mind. So there's a huge system constraint there because the growing population, there's only so much more infrastructure they could possibly build. And frankly, it would be impossible to build their way out of it. The inverse is here in Kansas City, where we have more highway miles per capita than most American cities. And so we have an abundance of infrastructure. In fact, probably more infrastructure than we need for the 460,000 people that live in Kansas City, Missouri, or the larger metro area as a whole. So we have the complete opposite problem, where we have very little constraints on how much infrastructure we have. So that creates very different pressures. But there is still both cities struggle from the need for a cultural shift. The identity of Los Angeles as a car city is not very different from Kansas City as a whole. And when you think about trying to get people out of the mindset, for example, of free parking, that is a major change. You know, expecting people to think that that real estate is of value and it is not being used to its highest and best value when it's left vacant on a weekend because it's used for corporate parking during the week and not used on the weekend and therefore left empty. That the highest and best use is not optimized as a parking space. You know, if we think about it, our cars are parked for about 95% of their life. And that is a considerable waste of space. So really trying to think about get shifting behavior and moving us away from the dependence on automobiles does come with things like pricing of parking. And I remember a conversation not too long ago when they started to look at pricing for parking in the River Market, because so many people were coming to downtown, parking their car in the River Market, and then riding the streetcar to their place of employment and leaving their car there all day. So the retailers were struggling to have parking available in their neighborhood because people were parking all day. That was something that received some backlash initially. And I think it is a culture change that we see in all American cities, that when you start to price things differently, people resist it. But the reality is that what we've seen in European cities is that when you start pricing things, service improves, conditions improve for people, and suddenly it's not so bad. And people start to find ways of accepting that new pricing and start to either shift their behavior or at least start to account for the cost of parking as part of their decision in making a trip.
I will say that I can give a good example of that. In Europe, you have to pay to use the restrooms, but those restrooms are always nice and always totally clean. So yeah. I never mind paying the 50 cents, even though like every time someone would come visit me, they would be like, what? I had to pay to go to the restroom? I'm like, yes, but it will be spotless in there.
And we're seeing that in cities across the country, testing it with high occupancy vehicle lanes, for example. So on the highways, you'll start to see tolls basically being charged for carpool lanes. And so if it gives you the incentive to think about, I either put more people in my car and make better use of this car, because most cars are not taking advantage of the 5+ seats that they have available to it. And there usually is just one occupant in it. You may actually double up and add more people to avoid paying a higher fee, or you pay a higher price because you get a faster lane and you're not stuck in the traffic like everybody else. Now, there's going to be a social equity issue when it comes to road pricing as whole. And we're seeing this conversation really come to fruition now in New York City, where they're looking at congestion pricing. But the reality of our technology capabilities and the ability to look at market segmentation means that there's still a possibility to balance the way that roads are priced with the equity issue, that we can start to parse out different levels of payment based on income and basically how the roadway is being used.
Do you think that there are issues related to public transit that you found to be pretty Midwest specific or unique to the area?
You know, I think there's a smaller percentage of the population that rely on public transit. So it being seen as an essential public utility, perhaps here in Kansas City, is maybe less obvious for the average person than in a city like LA, where, you know, you have the lowest income brackets in the city relying exclusively on public transit to get around. So you do see some of that to some extent. But like I said, I have a lot of confidence in the leadership at KCATA right now and the work that they're doing to really rethink how to position public transit. And I'm someone who, I love a good road trip. I've traveled all over this country. I've put my two kids in the back of the car and we've explored city after city on great road trips. I hate driving and I try not to drive as much as I can. Public transit in this city is actually very reliable. There's, you know, an app you can use to buy your bus fare, so you don't have to worry about cash or how you buy your transit pass. That was always a barrier for me getting into new markets, not necessarily knowing, you know, is there a vending machine somewhere? Do I have to go to a convenience store? We have a free streetcar, which is incredible. It's a beautiful experience. It's easy to get on. It's level boarding, which makes it extremely accessible. So if you're someone who has to roll in with a wheelchair or with a stroller, it makes it really easy to get on and off. So we've done a lot of really great stuff to improve that experience. The challenge is that if you can't get there from here in a reasonable amount of time, people are not going to choose it. So one of the things that's happening right now is something called a system redesign. So KCATA is looking at all of the fixed routes that it has all over the city and region and asking the question of, are we really solving this with the right solution? So does a 60-person bus really fit the right model for moving people across these communities? And really, you know, timing and schedules and availability of different types of solutions will really transform the effectiveness of moving people across the region. We've seen a considerable improvement in cities like Seattle and cities across the globe that have focused on how do they kind of address system balance and the need for real high quality service for where it's going to be used the most.
You were Kansas City's first chief innovation officer. How did that role come about, and what were your job duties and areas of focus?
So I was certainly not what I think they were thinking they were looking for when they hired a chief innovation officer. They actually had posted the role. This was a position that reported to both the mayor and city manager, which makes it very unique because as a political appointee, but having a very close working relationship with the city manager's office, you had a really unique opportunity to see across the entire organization. And the goal was initially focused not on technology at all, in fact, and really did not become a technology until I created a partnership for the smart city infrastructure near the end of my term, but really about civic innovation. So how do we do more with less? How do we create a culture of experimentation and change within City Hall, recognizing that the challenges are getting harder, but the tools that we have to solve them are not necessarily kind of falling at our footsteps, at our feet. So we really need to do more to think differently and cultivate a culture of innovation and change to address this. So my I was not what they were thinking they would hire as an architect and community organizer, but because they really thought they'd hire someone who had a master's in public administration and Six Sigma training and things like that, and really thinking about lean process improvement. And to some extent, I went out and got that experience. Denver actually has a really cool program where they train all of their staff on lean and Six Sigma to empower them to think through process improvement without any new resources. It's pretty incredible. So I really focused on how do we bring people together within City Hall to problem solve across silos? How do we bring new players to the table like UMKC Law School or the private sector or even young professionals that had not been civically involved before to the table to help solve problems and really kind of think differently about how we could work as a government? And through that, we did a bunch of different things, whether I supported the development of a citywide strategic plan, which is something that the city manager and mayor championed, which was really quite an incredible way of saying, hey, we are going to state our goals publicly. They'll be measurable, and we're going to hold ourselves accountable to them. And so we really thought through, you know, what does that look like? How do you stand that up? And I got to work very closely with the city manager's office in thinking through how innovation and technology could potentially play a role in that. And then I developed a digital roadmap for the city. So, you know, Google Fiber was a very catalytic moment for many here in Kansas City, particularly around entrepreneurship and digital equity. And the digital roadmap was a kind of a mechanism by which we could say, hey, here's where we'd like to go now that we have all these things at our feet, that we can really start to leverage them to as assets for all of our community. And so it looked at things like open data, civic engagement using technology, smart cities, and other ways of thinking through how we could leverage technology and data in the digital age to for better outcomes for the city of Kansas City, Missouri. So Kansas City was I was the 13th chief innovation officer in the country and the first woman to be appointed into the role. We have seen the growth of this space quite significantly. In fact, all of my partners kind of came out of the civic innovation space in cities across the country. So we really, I think it's a new era in local government. And actually, I would encourage everyone to think about giving themselves a chance to look at local government as a place to work because they are doing things that change and affect people's daily lives every single day that they go to work, which is quite powerful.
That's awesome. I would say when we're talking about public transit in Kansas City, there's a glaring issue, and that being how do you connect downtown with the airport? I'm wondering what you think is the most workable solution for improving that.
So I think it has to, like I said, we have to think systemically. There's no one single solution. Just putting, for example, rapid transit between downtown and the airport is not enough. We have to create the carrots and sticks necessary to do that. So there's a couple things we need to consider. First of all, is that mobility option available to us in lieu of you know, driving yourself or taking an Uber and Lyft where you're still relying on someone else to basically drive you out there, you're not actually reducing emissions or vehicle miles traveled. So Los Angeles, for example, has a flyaway model where you can go to a major convening transit point across the region and take a very nice coach bus with Wi-Fi right to the terminal. And I think Union Station here would be a great central point for people to meet up and take a similar type of bus out to the airport. In order for us to see that type of program work, however, we need help from people who pay to subsidize parking for their employees, for example, who are traveling for work, to ensure that they're actually using these services, because in order for these services to survive, you have to have ridership. So we need some help from the private sector to help create those carrots to incentivize that behavior change. And on the other side of it, the airport, run by the aviation department for the city of Kansas City, Missouri, also has to have new alternatives to generating revenue, because currently it relies quite heavily on parking revenue from both its surface parking and its structured parking at the airport. And so that model, unfortunately, kind of helps continue to provide the kind of supply to encourage the behavior of everyone just driving themselves out and parking for a relatively cheap amount, either at the circle structures or out on the kind of the surface lots outside of the airport. I think there needs to be more done there to rethink that. We obviously cannot eliminate the fact that people will have to drive themselves, particularly because we're a regional airport that serves a very large geographic area. So people will have to drive themselves because you're not going to be able to kind of cater to all users. But we probably don't need to provide as much parking. And when we do provide parking, it should be priced based on demand so that people can consider their options if there are options and really evaluate that in a much more market-driven way.
I know you've done a lot of domestic and international travel throughout your life. Does your experience in urban planning and transit infrastructure impact the way that you experience new communities?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, yes, absolutely. I mean, I think you knew the answer to that question, but
this is an interview.
It's one of those things where there is something very unique about experiencing a city from shared mobility. I would say absolutely. I went to cities I grew up in a suburb, but I started living in cities when I went to university and haven't looked back. In fact, I've rarely owned a car most of my adult life because I've relied heavily on public transit. And I've lived in cities all over this country, as well as in Canada and overseas. And it really, that experience of getting to know a community intimately by seeing the people and interacting with communities on public transit really changes your perspective. And so I actually seek those experiences out when I travel, where I'm there for a much shorter time period, because it is a great way to get more immersed in what's happening. And when we took the few years hiatus from Kansas City and moved my children out to LA for a couple of years, we actually rode transit with them almost exclusively, because they connected much more quickly with their city, kind of getting a lay of the land, a mental map for a then 3 and 5 year old of their city in a very different way than if they were sitting in the backseat of a car staring at the parents' heads and not interacting with us. They knew, you know, where their stops were. They knew the bus drivers. They even knew people riding the buses at certain times of day when they were going to and from school. And that experience of watching them perceive their city as children really helped convince me that we need to open up that possibility for more children. And I've actually been working here in Kansas City to rethink public transit as an option for schools so that we can start to encourage more school-age children to ride public transit by making it possible and actually allowable at the state level.
And it's something you definitely see in some of the bigger cities, the kids riding the bus, riding the metro or riding.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty common.
Yeah, they don't even think about it, except it's just the way you do it, you know, and it is really cool. I mean, my kids know exactly how to get to school. And in fact, I'm trying to kind of, you know, temper some of my 7-year-old's expectations that she'll be able to walk herself to school next year. So, you know, that's the type of confidence I want her to have, that she knows where she's going and recognizes her city and what's available to her. And in fact, she actually will protest taking a car ride unnecessarily because for her, it's not as enjoyable. She doesn't get to hang out with us. She doesn't get to hang out with other people. And it's, you know, not as interesting sitting strapped into the back seat in a booster.
And I guess that's how you start changing the view for the future.
Absolutely. You know, if I can't walk the walk, I shouldn't talk the talk. That's how I feel.
Well, Ashley, thank you so much for joining us. Ashley can be found on social media at AZHandKC, and CityFi can be found at Team CityFi. Also, don't forget to follow Coastless, of course, on social media at CoastlessKC. Safe travels.